Ich bin ein Government, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Eric Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of our Institute, fellow analyst, and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
As always, it's good to be with you. I'm back from my trip to Los Angeles. Hopefully, I've got enough energy to make sense on this evening as we tape.
Well, did you get yourself a nice Southern California tan while you were out there, Charles?
I did make it to the beach one day. Here's what a lot of people don't realize. When you're in Hollywood, California, you're 15 miles from the beach.
I was going to say, you're nowhere near the beach when you're there.
And they think you're right on the beach. You're not. You have to get in the car and drive. And believe me, driving on an L.A. freeway... It's an experience, for instance, any time between about 9 in the morning and about 7 in the evening. It's there are places where you don't want to be. And, of course, we ended up being in those places. So we tried to come home from the beach at about 4 o'clock on Tuesday night. And just let me tell you that we spent about 40 minutes on an entrance ramp. So you have to be very patient there.
No doubt. No doubt. Well, we're glad to have you back in the rather stabler climes of Ohio. So I'm glad that you made your trip well. But Chuck, while you were on your trip, there were some things that were happening. And ladies and gentlemen, as you know, if you've been listening to us, you've been running a few best of programs the last couple of days because, well, we tried to get as much in ahead of time as possible before Chuck had to take off on his trip. But we both realized that there was probably going to be a lot of things that were going to be coming up this particular week. And we really didn't want to can everything, but we didn't get the opportunity to record while Chuck was on the West Coast because, well, obviously sometimes the Skype works a little better the closer you are, I think, Charles.
That coupled with the 3-hour time difference and the fact that I was working all weekend at a trade show really kind of combined. You know, I'd come in the evening and the only thing I wanted to do was get something to eat. And maybe walk around a little bit to burn off some of the frustration of the day. And by the time we get done, it's 9 o'clock our time, but it's 12 o'clock here.
or the other night when it was 1 o'clock in the morning and we were sitting there saying, maybe we're going to have to go with the best stuff. But anyhow, we're back live today, ladies and gentlemen. And it's a good thing, too, because as you know, there have been some things going on this week somewhere in the South, specifically in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's where the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, is holding their presidential nominating convention. Now, a week ago, the RNC held their presidential nominating convention in even farther south, Tampa, Florida. And we talked a little bit about some of the shenanigans that were going on there. And you've probably heard about things that happened with rules changes and the platform committees and all that good stuff. And, well, you know, that's just part and parcel for a large major presidential nominating convention of the two major parties. Every 4 years, you're going to hear much of the same thing. You're going to hear about fights over what goes in the platform and who gets credit for this, that, and the other, and who gets to speak when. And those are the standard, Chuck, almost like the operating rules for how conventions go. But one of the things that you don't see very often, but we did this year, was basically an out-and-out breathtaking assertion by one of the major parties. And, of course, the major party that I'm talking about is the Democratic Party. And when they started the convention, Chuck, at the beginning, and I'm not sure what their stated public reason was for this little vignette, but I think it set a tone that we ought to pay attention to because it really drives home just how different worldviews are between liberals and the rest of us. Now, Chuck, I believe you have a clip that we want to play for folks in case they missed it, if they weren't like glued to their television sets to watch the opening of the Democratic National Convention this week, earlier this week. They might have missed this, but I want to make sure that our folks, at least in our listening audience, hear this little clip.
Definitely. I have it right here.
We are committed to all people. We do believe you can use government in a good way. Well, government's the only thing that we all belong to. We're in different churches, different clubs, but we're together as a part of our city or our county or our state and our nation.
That's the portion of it that I have.
Yeah, that's basically the audio portion because the first of it starts off with a lot of visuals, various ethnicities and various walks of life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then it goes into, and what I wanted to bring up, Chuck, in this to our listeners, was that that claim, that bald-faced assertion, done without a smile on their face because they're really serious about this, that government is the only thing we all belong to. Now, I know you could cite me for reading too much into it, but there's two ways to look at that claim. The one that, like, the brotherhood of man, we're all in the brotherhood of government, or, if you want to be a little bit more sinister about it, that we all are subjects to government and we belong to government as a possession.
And that is the way a lot of people are interpreting this. And in fact, I think this was an attempt to counter something that Clint Eastwood asked at the Republican convention, that do you belong to the government? Yeah. Well, the answer is no, I do not. Although, at this point, they are pretending like I do. Otherwise, how can they tell me, for instance, if you take Mayor Bloomberg, how can he tell me that I'm not allowed to eat a supersized meal at McDonald's, or I have to eat something that's cooked with trans fats, or I have to eat something that's below a certain calorie level, or I can't eat something with a certain amount of sugar in it? When the government begins to move in and take over things that you yourself are responsible for and that you yourself are supposed to be in charge of, then all of a sudden, all those things begin to fall like dominoes. So once government begins to take over your healthcare, they can begin to dictate what those things that you need to do to maintain your healthcare. So in other words, they're saying, we're paying for it, therefore you have to do this. That does make you a piece of property. It makes you a slave owned by the state. And in this case, in New York City, you're owned by the state in the city. Now, what I mean by that, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here. Here's a little Greek English lesson for you. There's a word, and it's called synecdoche. Barry, are you familiar with the synecdoche?
Yes.
When you read it, it looks like something else. It looks like it says synecdoche or something like that.
Synecdoche, that's right.
S-Y-N-E-C-D-O-C-H-E.
That's right.
N-E-C-D-O-C-H-E, synecdoche. What a synecdoche is a word, for instance, that says applies the characteristics of one thing to a single entity. So, in other words, if you come by and there's a new street sign up in your street, you say the city hung a new sign. That's a synecdoche because the entire city did not show up to hang the sign. Two guys that worked for the city came out and hung that sign. But in their capacity, they represented the city. That is a synecdoche. And that is what we're talking about here. The city is the state insofar as it is the government. It represents the state can be any form of the government. So before somebody goes off and tries to say, he said the state when he really meant the city, it's a synecdoche, folks.
Exactly. But I'm not so sure that the Democrats in that little vignette were actually engaging in using a synecdoche for this, because honestly, I do believe that I took it originally, Chuck, to think about that, like the Brotherhood of Man from the 60s peace movement, which Barack Obama is part and parcel of, that what they were trying to say was, we're all in the Brotherhood of Government. That's the only thing we all belong to. Well, you know what they missed, Chuck? Is that we all belong to the human race. But if government is the only thing that we all belong to, obviously the DNC must see some classes of citizens as less than human. And I think I know which class that is, Charles, because in a major floor fight, they had to fight to put God back into the platform of the DNC. And even the reference that they had in there was a weak and vague one to start with. But delegates fought tooth and nail to remove it because they don't want any kind of Christian baggage in the Democratic Party.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And there was another thing that they fought to take out, and that was a reference to the city of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And it's interesting that that has been such a hot button issue. And in fact, let's talk about this for a minute. You and I spoke about this today. Who was the chairman of the Democratic Platform Committee?
It was Ohio's own ex-governor, Ted Strickland.
Ted Strickland was the chairman of the committee that put together the Democratic National Committee platform, complete with God out of it and complete with Jerusalem removed as the capital city of Israel.
Yes.
There is a reason for that. Basically, that is a hot button issue. The Democratic National Committee is in support of the Palestinian Authority, wants Jerusalem to be an open city, not be the capital of Israel, wants to deny the fact that's Israeli territory. And we can go into the ins and outs of the 1947 war and the 1967 war and the 1956 war and the 1973 war We're not going to, because we've only got about 4 minutes left, and it's too complex to go into. But Ted, at the last minute, gets up after this thing has been basically accepted already by the party, and we go through a dog and pony show, where we go through this floor fight with Ted Strickland leading the fight, giving his heartfelt rendition about how he's an ordained Methodist minister. And no, we can't leave God out of the platform. Oh, how horrible that we left God out of the platform. He must be in there, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, Ted, how come you didn't insist in committee? The chairman has an awful lot of power with that kind of thing. The fact is, Ted Strickland could have insisted. The president of the United States could have stepped forward and said, look, guys, I want it in there. It would have stayed in. But the fact is, nobody did anything about it until it was out. Now, all of a sudden, the president comes forward with this amendment to it. We're going to amend it on the floor. And the first thing that came to my mind when I heard this scenario, how this came up, I said, this is Kabuki theater writ large. Everybody's dressed up in their white makeup and they're stomping around on stage and making it look like they've got to get this done. Fact is, Barry, this was done so that Barack Obama could be the hero for getting God back in the platform.
Well, of course. Of course.
It was
And honestly, Chuck, it wasn't so much the God reference that they were worried about. It was the reference to Jerusalem because of the large number of Jewish supporters, donors, and voters that the Democratic Party, including their national chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, really were about to lose by making such a bold elimination of that reference from their platform.
Well, I'm going to be quite honest. Wasserman Schultz essentially embarrassed herself on a couple of shows where she was interviewed about this thing, and she talked about, well, it wasn't intentional. It wasn't intentional. Of course it was intentional. And that particular reaction shows me that it was intentional, and the intent was that the president was going to step forward and get this stuff put back in and then be a hero. Well, here's the problem, Barry. When they were taking the floor vote to amend it, the chairman, Mayor Villagrosa of Los Angeles, where I was, basically decided to make it a voice vote.
Yeah.
Well, if you listen to the recording, and according to all the reports, there was a teleprompter. He takes the voice vote. All those in favor say aye. You hear screams of aye. All opposed say no. Well, it's very clear, and there has been analysis done of the audio since this time, and it's very clear that the no's win. In other words, the no's are the people who are voting against
putting it back in the platform. That's right.
Chairman Villagrosa says, If you listen to the audio, he says, okay, we're going to do this again. Because the teleprompter that he's reading says, in the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it. Well, very clearly, in the opinion of the chair, the ayes did not have it. So he says, we're going to do this again. So they do it again, Barry. All those in favor say aye. The ayes speak up. All opposed say no. The no's scream. And once again, the no's take it. And finally he goes, he hems and haws, and he you can hear it. And somebody in the background says, you've got to let them do what they're going to do.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Yeah. I actually heard the audio. So he takes the vote again. And finally he says, and clearly again, the no's win the vote. And he says, in the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it.
Yeah.
You and I know parliamentary procedure. At least I know it nowhere near as closely as you do. But what someone in the delegation should have stood up and said,
I challenge the ruling of the chair.
We want a standing vote or to take a roll call vote by state.
Well, first you have to vote to whether to uphold the chair's ruling. Actually, you have to, before the chair makes that call, you have to call for a division, which is a standing or a voice or, well, you were had a voice vote. The next thing would be a standing or a roll call vote, and it would be up to the determiner, the caller, to make that determination. But that's what should have been done, but it's obvious they needed to get this thing fixed, and fixed quickly, because they had just handed Mitt Romney's campaign a massive PR tool to use going all the way to November.
Oh, well, they still have it, because what was required was a two-thirds majority.
And they didn't get it.
They didn't even get a simple majority. They got beat, and they just basically decreed it passed, as they were going to do with health care, if you'll recall. This is not a new trick in the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, Barry, it's also not a new trick in the Republican Party, because if you recall, when they ran through some rules changes, they did the same thing in the Republican side. So,
yeah, I do remember that, and you're right. Both sides have done what we would consider ethically questionable parliamentary maneuvers in order to get to where they want to be.
And you know what? We're short on time.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's usually what happens when we get rolling on some good issues. We're going to continue this on just this, but on many other things that are coming out now that the two parties have gone through the motions of having their national conventions. Now we get into what I call the silly season. And so stay with us in the upcoming weeks, and we'll dissect and analyze quite a bit going on from a biblical world.
Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.